This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, located just off 290 and the 610 Loop, with a mixture of modern and mid-century homes providing families room to grow. More information at nnmd.org.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombwealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout as we do our favorite thing every week, Brandon. That's talk a little politics, what's going around in the world and here in Texas. But just straight off the top, President Trump has been threatening a shutdown of the government. What's going on, Brandon?
Yeah, we've got threats. We've got trials. We've got rifts. We've got Bigfoot. This is the perfect week for politics junkies. Do not take your cleanse this week. This week is too cool, too interesting. Yeah, so the president has threatened a shutdown of government over the issue of the long-promised border wall. It's not clear whether Congress is really willing to bite on this. They're frankly also out of town for 2 weeks. Both the House and Senate are in recess. The clock is running out in terms of funding the budget. I think 2 more months, right, is all that the nation has to be able to pay its bills on time. And to me, I think the worst part of this is just that the timing is really bad for the president and for the Republicans. They don't want a government shutdown or even the threat of a government shutdown this close to an election, especially when, you know, a lot of these seats are really precariously balanced politically.
Yeah, I think that the president is sort of the boy who cried wolf when it comes to the wall. He wants to keep periodically reminding the voters that he cares about the wall and that he wants the wall to be built, and that, truth be told, that a good percentage of the wall is already being built. He wants to keep it alive, but he has no intention of shutting down the government over this. We've had this issue come up multiple times in the last year and a half since he's been president, and every time he has blinked. So I would not expect him to do anything more. But as you said, we're leading into the midterm elections. Yeah. He wants to remind the Trump faithful that he is still very much committed to building that wall and having Mexico pay for it.
My fable knowledge is a little shaky at this moment. Did the boy who cried wolf get eaten by the wolf? Is that
what ends up happening? I
believe he did. So what's the analogy here? He's
going to
lose the election?
So it's almost like literally bricks falling on top of the president.
Right, exactly, yeah. Politically, yeah, sort of covering him in a fine dust of the wall, right? Well, it gets worse, though, right? Because this week, there's a beginning of a trial for Donald Trump's one-time campaign chairman, who is accused of essentially taking big money, $60 million, as a political consultant to the government of Ukraine and failing to report it on his taxes. So this is the kind of first shot across the bow from the Mueller investigation. Is it going to hurt Trump?
Well, I mean, I think it hurts him in the sense that he was a leading figure in the Trump campaign. Mm-hmm. This trial is not about Russian intervention in the election. It's not about collusion. In fact, it's not directly related to the Trump campaign at all. Paul Manafort was basically an unregistered lobbyist for the Russian-backed Ukrainian government. The argument I think that's being made and how the linkage is that Manafort is effectively an agent of the Russian government by this Ukrainian proxy. He then becomes chairman of the Trump campaign. And then ergo, you have this sort of linkage between the Russians and the Trump campaign. That's what this is all about. Mm-hmm. And I think the real question was whether or not Manafort would take some sort of deal and as a means to avoid going forward or any potential jail time and essentially sort of flip on the president. And that doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, he can always change his mind, right? He said he wouldn't, but with a prospect of facing, what, something like 270 years in prison, maybe that starts to look a little bit more appealing. So we'll see how it comes through. This, I think, is a test for the Mueller probe. I mean, as you say, this is not about the special counsel. It's not about the Russian collusion exactly, but it's in that orbit. And I think politically, we'll see kind of what damage it does to the president and to the Republican Party more broadly. But I think ultimately, like, just the amount of detail that has come out of this would make the man from Uncle blush. Like, did you see the $15,000 ostrich coat that Manafort, like, supposedly bought with the money from the Ukrainian government? government. It is like stunning, Jay. Just stunning. It makes all of your ostrich coat seem all the less weak.
The idea of an ostrich coat to me just seems so ridiculous. And so it just adds to the...
And maybe look good on him. You don't know.
Well, maybe. Maybe. But, you know, speaking of the Republican Party establishment and the damage to the Republican Party, there's now a seeming ongoing war. It's been in the last few months now, but it was really sort of, I think, come to the front burner now because of the North Dakota Senate race between the president and the Koch brothers and their larger organization and consortium of about 100 or 200 high net worth individuals that contribute money. They're major contributors of the Republican Party, and they're trying to create their specific brand apart from the Republican Party.
Yeah, the president had tweeted out essentially that the Koch brothers had become a kind of total joke in Republican circles. To me, it's like your uncle and your grandmother are fighting at Easter dinner. It's awkward. And I think it reflects the fact that there is this kind of internecine battle between these factions of the Republican Party. Trump wants to own the party. And I think that in some ways, the party doesn't mind having that a little bit. But he's going to have to fight for it because there are these individuals in this, what Steve Bannon calls the donor class, who aren't going to give it up so easily. So I think that this kind of populism versus economic conservatism is going to be the kind of rift that's going to go forward. I don't know that it'll have an impact on 2018, but I do think it's going to have an impact on 2020.
You know, we don't often think of Donald Trump as sort of fighting the ideological battle, but I agree with you. This is essentially what it is, sort of his brand of nationalist-based conservatism versus this kind of libertarian-tinged conservatism that the Koch brothers have embodied. They came out and said they'd be willing to work with Democrats that are supporting him. They're not supporting a challenger to Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota that Trump is backing and really wants more support for. It's an interesting kind of dynamic. We'll see what happens in 18. And I really think it'll be interesting to see what happens in 20 because they've shown no indication at all for supporting Donald Trump. In fact, he's probably the lone Republican they ended up not supporting or didn't support, rather, in the 2016 cycle.
And if the primary comes to be competitive like we think it might, then the battle of the dollars is going to be in play. And if the Koch brothers back somebody who challenges Donald Trump, then it's going to be definitely one of the most expensive races for a primary in American history.
Well, we know that in the 2016 election, there has been pretty definitive allegations and statements made about Russian interference in the election process. A lot of it was on social media. But if we think that was in the past, I think reality has set in that the 2018 election is certainly in danger as well. Facebook has done an internal assessment looking at various pages and sites that it hosts, and it's found pretty compelling evidence that there is a disinformation campaign that was actively pursued for this cycle by the Russian government.
It's such a thorny issue to deal with technologically as well as politically, right? The balance between free speech and having Facebook serve as this kind of platform and the need to be able to tamp down this kind of tampering is, I think, really complicated. I think, honestly, the sad truth is that it doesn't take much to foster disinformation campaign. Facebook can do some things to limit that, but ultimately, just a little bit of misinformation can go a very long way. The research on this is really interesting and suggests that even with corrections, people still believe the information that was incorrect. So it's going to be really difficult to undo this. And until partisanship is sort of quelled in its current form, I don't see any way that you can totally eliminate this.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, this sort of confirmation bias problem. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially the idea that if I think about something, or if I have a prevailing notion about something and I see more information that reinforces it, I will seek out that information and disregard counter evidence, even when that evidence is really probably a little more credible.
Yeah.
So this is going to be an ongoing problem. Good for Facebook for doing it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they aren't going to need to fundamentally change the way they operate. Maybe more on the way the European model is right now, because this is going to continue. It's not going to stop. I would suspect we just don't have the Russians involved. I bet there's a lot of foreign governments involved trying to influence the American electorate, because if you think about it, it makes sense from their perspective. And frankly, the United States has been trying to influence foreign elections for a very long time.
Interesting. Yeah. Now you've kind of kicked up the kind of intrigue level a notch here for the week, right? Well, one thing that Facebook could do is to try to install a disinformation campaign about the existence of the swamp ape, Jay. I'm talking about Bigfoot. We all know and love this mythical forest dwelling creature.
But apparently some of us
exist.
But apparently some of us love Bigfoot a little bit more than others.
Even more. Just when you thought that the 2018 cycle could not get more weird, here we have the introduction of Bigfoot politically into this. Now, Jay, what happened here?
Well, a Republican candidate for Congress, Denver Riggleman from the state of Virginia, put out what can most aptly be described as Bigfoot erotica, essentially images of, allegedly images of Bigfoot with some blacked out areas.
Yes. Apparently, some sensor bars.
Now, this was not anybody hacking his social media accounts. This was not someone sort of inadvertently taking it over. It wasn't accidental. This was intentionally done by Denver Riggleman.
He put his own face onto Bigfoot's body, right?
Yes, he did. And apparently thought it was a joke and funny. And, you know, this is the state of American politics.
There you go. So he's running against a woman named Leslie Cockburn, who was an investigative journalist. And there's one thing we know about investigative journalists is that they are dogged and they will not give it up. So this was bound to be found and outed. I don't know if it'll be, you know, dispositive in this race, but it's fascinating to think about all the ways in which social media can get candidates in trouble. So this is just another one of those examples. So I just found it to be really interesting. And as somebody who believes in the existence of Bigfoot, I think it's really important that we bring Bigfoot and the history and legacy to the forefront, right?
Well, speaking of Bigfoots, let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk a little about Texas.
I noticed you got away from that quick. So
yes, I did.
That.
I did. Well,
save
you know,
in
a similar way, it's not completely unrelated. There is a Bigfoot trying to plant their brand here in Texas, and that's the president of the United States. He sees his Republican brethren across the country, in some cases, in trouble. We know that in Texas, a lot of Democrats running for Congress are outraising their opponents. Well, six members of Congress, Representative Michael Burgess of Louisville, John Carter of Round Rock, Michael Cloud of Victoria, Mike Conway of Midland, John Culberson of Houston, and Pete Sessions of Dallas have all received the maximum contribution from Donald Trump. And several of them are incumbents, but you've got Sessions, Culberson, and John Carter with real opponents who've outraised them significantly. All three of their opponents, M.J. Hager for John Carter, Colin Allred against Pete Sessions, and Lizzie Fletcher against John Culberson. All three have outraised well over $1 million. In big race, big trouble. Is this a good or a bad thing that Donald Trump is getting involved?
I think that this is what presidents typically do. I think the president has done this a little bit later than most presidents in the cycle. He's leveraging political money to win party loyalty and rewarding past support. So some of these folks are people who are in jeopardy, potentially losing their seat, but some like Michael Burgess and Mike Conway aren't going to lose their seat. This is just a way to kind of support their past actions. Conway has been a big supporter on some agriculture issues, as well as trying to reform some of the stuff Ted Cruz actually filed legislation on to eliminate a kind of surcharge on individual fees that are paid by churches and nonprofits. So the president is doing generally what presidents do. I think he needs to. I mean, I think that the fact that Trump underperformed in Texas suggests that his brand and therefore the Republican Party brand is weakening. And so he needs to shore up support in any way possible to get them back on board. The downside for these Republicans is I think that there's probably an opportunity there for their opponents to challenge them on everything Trump does, right? So now, like, they're linked together. There's no fire escape exit now. Like, they're on the same train, and it either goes all the way or it stops and crashes. So that's, I think, one potential problem for these Republicans if something explodes in Washington.
I mean, what jumped out at me, I mean, aside from the fact that in some of these swing districts, a Trump endorsement is a bad thing.
Yes.
Combined with the fact that Will Hurd, the congressman that has probably been the most critical of him, Republican from San Antonio in the Valley area, he's not on this list. He probably wouldn't want it, and I'm sure he wouldn't be getting it from Donald Trump since he's been so critical.
And nothing from Pete Olson, too. So exactly what the president's thinking here, I don't know. There could be more coming, but this clearly represents a list of people that the president backs for good or for bad, right?
Well, Brandon, we've had a huge controversy about the idea of 3D printed guns. We know that in Austin, Texas, Cody Wilson and an organization that he founded called Defense Distributed there are a sort of an anarchist, libertarian anarchist group, extreme Second Amendment advocates, put out the blueprints to basically download and print a 3D weapon. There's a court that has filed an injunction. Attorney General from New Jersey filed it, and that has been temporarily put on hold. But those plans are out there. They've been out there for a few weeks. Thousands have already been downloaded. What does this mean? And is Texas kind of back in the mix as sort of the ground zero for Second Amendment rights?
Yeah, it definitely is. Although I do think that we've seen some wary Republicans on this issue. It was asked of several of the statewide officials, including John Cornyn, what this might mean. And they were a little reluctant to embrace it as fully as some have. So I don't know that we're going to see this really be pushed. My guess is we're going to see some kind of regulation here. But in general, the regulations that are in place haven't caught up to the technology that's available. So my guess is we're going to probably see something here. And if there's nothing else that Republicans can get behind in terms of Second Amendment rights, and in terms of fostering some kind of a common sense reform on Second Amendment issues, I think that this is likely to be one of them.
Well, we don't know how much guns will be come up in subsequent debates, but we know for one thing is for certain, there's going to be a lot of U.S. Senate debates. We called it here on this show. We said there was going to be debates, Brandon, and lo and behold, five debates between Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz, Lincoln Douglas. Part two here, we might have something.
It's good, yeah, except that it'll be kind of all Texas focused, right? And it'll have a kind of, it'll have a much more Texas flair, which is good. So the Senator Cruz has identified five debates in Fridays that are more or less in a kind of standard debate format. Beto O'Rourke, as challenger, has suggested that maybe they add a sixth debate in El Paso. They have the format be a more unscripted town hall style, and maybe they change the issues to be not so stilted and more broad. So there are going to be debates. I think the question here is kind of, you know, who benefits from these debates? And in my mind, I think you've got risks for both. I mean, for Cruz, whose confidence is high coming off of a basketball win over Jimmy Kimmel, I think that there is a risk because essentially he is going to introduce a fairly charismatic Beto O'Rourke to Texans who don't know who he is, right? Polling that just came out in the race suggests that O'Rourke really isn't well known by something like 35% or more of Texans. So that's a big problem. And I think, though, for O'Rourke is a real challenge because this is not the same kind of format that he's used to, right? If it's a very tight kind of 1 minute, you know, rebuttal, 2 minute discussion, kind of moderated, focused debate, then it doesn't play to his strengths in the same way. So I think that it's potentially challenging for O'Rourke, too. To me, though, I think the biggest issue is just the number. So much happens every week, right? Then you're going to have to respond to those things, especially Ted Cruz, right, who is in the party of an unpopular president. So if something happens that Cruz has to respond to, then he's playing defense, not offense.
I think the five, the number five is interesting. I think you will end up seeing a sixth debate.
Yeah.
The formatting issue I agree with. I mean, O'Rourke's strength is sort of the town hall style format. He's done very well in these kind of informal settings. He's done a lot of them. Cruz is much better as a sort of traditional standard debater,
yeah,
where he's the opportunity to rebut. And he is very good in that format. I think you'll probably end up with a mix or a compromise, or maybe 3-3, because
yeah,
I do think they're going to end up in El Paso. The date is, the timing is interesting because they're all Friday night.
Yeah.
I think O'Rourke had suggested let's move it back to maybe Wednesday,
yeah,
which also coincides to be probably the biggest viewing night. Yeah. For most people. So that combination will be interesting. But I agree with you. I think what's driving this entire debate is the simple fact and the reality now that, as you said, O'Rourke may not be known, but we effectively have a tie race. We have had now at least a half a dozen polls with varying samples that seem to indicate that this race is anywhere between tied to Cruz plus five. And that is close enough to create real heartburn for Ted Cruz and give real hope for Beto O'Rourke. And so the challenge is going to be, I think that makes a lot of discomfort for Cruz, particularly when many of these same polls show Greg Abbott up 15, 16, 17 points.
Yeah.
And so it's not so much the sample. It's not so much that. It's the simple fact that Ted Cruz is really unpopular.
Yeah.
Beto O'Rourke, the people who know him like him, he wants to be able to, I think, once and for all, show him as a liberal that is not in touch with Texas values.
Yeah, and so your thinking is that Cruz agreed to this because he is underwater in terms of favorability, and he's going to hope that this is going to remind people why they voted for him in the first place, and to suggest that O'Rourke, who's not well known, can now be defined as being too liberal for Texas. So you think that Cruz basically is gonna take these, right? He's a Princeton debating champion. So you think he's like overconfident, or you think that this is something that he's doing in the best interest of the state, or what?
No, I think it's both. I think he thinks that he can take it, and I think he can remind base Republican voters that may be wavering on him.
Yeah.
That O'Rourke is too liberal to be elected.
Yeah, like it could be worse, right?
Right.
Here's this. Here's me. Make a sharp contrast.
Right. A sharp contrast. I think for O'Rourke, it plays to what he wants, right? He wants to be on the same stage.
Yeah.
He wants to sort of be there and see this opportunity, sort of take the issues. I actually think it's a great opportunity because we're going to see a contrast, and
yeah,
we'll get to see kind of where the state wants to go moving forward.
Yeah.
Well, Brandon, we know, speaking of the state wanting to move forward, we know that our capital city has been doing a little self-reflection. They had a commission come out looking at the proliferation, or I should say proliferation, of the existence of many Confederate names and on monuments, and dealing with that issue. It's been a national issue.
Yeah.
Well, apparently some people have taken a step forward because the proverbial father of Texas, Stephen F. Austin's name, has come up as an objectionable name. So the question is, should the city of Austin have a different name?
Yeah, well, remember, the city of Austin used to be called something different. It used to be called Waterloo, so maybe they could change it back to Waterloo. Is this going too far, Jay? I mean, this is the Austin Equity Office came out with a list of landmarks they thought possibly should be changed. They threw the idea that the city's name was problematic out as a kind of, I don't know, political discussion point. Are they going too far with this? Or is this just a means to be able to kind of talk about this issue, which has serious implications and still does, because there are still vestiges of these monuments and street signs and even in the Capitol, right? These specific plaques that are designed to kind of evoke that sometimes untrue sense of where the country was.
Well, I think the issue with Stephen F. Austin and where his place in Texas history is something that probably, I mean, it's taught in school. We learn about in seventh grade in Texas history. And I think it's widely shown that the totality of Stephen F. Austin, not just as mm-hmm. sort of the father of Texas, but he in fact was a slave owner, essentially brought slavery to Texas mm-hmm. while making Texas what it became. That's a different issue than honoring Confederate soldiers who openly rebelled against the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure it's gone too far in the sense of wanting to let people know and understand, but I think it's probably gone too far if you're going to start taking Stephen F. Austin, Sam Houston,
mm-hmm.
and or leaders in the Texas Revolution off any honorific monuments.
I can see the shirts now, keep Austin Austin, right? Would you buy one?
Oh, I'd buy one. That's a great idea.
Great.
In fact, I think you just came
trademark,
up with an idea.
Trademark, yeah. Well, speaking of trademark, actually, we should trademark the term Flores Mentum, because there were some interesting developments in Senate District 19. This is a special election to replace Uresti, Senator Uresti, who resigned from office due to some serious issues revolving around his financial dealings, which he pleaded was found guilty on multiple penalties for. So this is an interesting development here, right? Republican ends up getting the biggest vote share in San Antonio region, which doesn't normally happen.
Well, it's a special election. You had multiple candidates in there, a total of seven, only three real candidates. Former Congressman Pete Gallego is in the runoff with Bill Flores and edged out of state representative Rolando Gutierrez. I'm not surprised. I think the more interesting thing to me was that the cumulative Democratic vote was considerably higher than what you normally see in that district. It's sort of a fool's gold victory.
Yeah.
For Flores, and I think Gallego's probably going to beat him pretty easily in that runoff.
Gallego's back, which is interesting, right? I mean, he was rejected in Congressional District 23 race, which also could be in jeopardy as this. I read this slightly differently. I mean, the low turnout here in Bexar County especially, I think is problematic. It was about 4%, which is low even for special election standards. On election day, the Democrats only got about 52% of the vote. They were winning in early voting, but this seems like they kind of just checked out. So Republicans may have a chance here to make some inroads. I don't think they'll win. I agree with you. But the fact that this is happening is potentially problematic for Gina Ortiz-Jones, who's running in Congressional District 23. I think that she is probably the one who's the most worried about this. The question also, too, is about this blue wave, right? Is it the case that Democrats are going to come out no matter what? I think it's a conditional story, right? In this election, in the runoff, you're not going to have a candidate from Bexar County. And so I don't know what that will do to turn out, especially in Bexar County, but it's not going to make it go any higher. And the Republicans aren't going down without a fight. So there's a kind of conditional effect to the blue wave in terms of interest and timing that could potentially hurt some Democrats who are running in places where there's a lot of anticipation that they might do well.
Yeah, and Gallego's not the kind of candidate that's going to foster sort of a lot of activist enthusiasm, right? I mean, he was sort of an old school, traditional, moderate Democrat, and which is why it was a bit of a shocker that he made it in. But that said, I do think the district is sort of the fundamentals are much more Democratic than Republican. Flores is not as well known as Gallego. There was about an 80% overlap between Congressional District 23, which is the congressional seat that he once held. And so I think he's a known factor, Flores less so. He may not have a resounding win, but he will make it over the finish line just barely.
Let's bet on this. We're going to bet a puffy taco on this, okay?
Oh, I'll take that. I'll take that bet. Puffy taco, I think you still owe me a Shiner Bock.
Hey, that's good. No, you're right. I do.
All right, well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to dive in and talk a little bit about a race most people don't talk about, but that's the Texas Agriculture Commissioner.
So, Jay, the Texas Ag Commissioner is a statewide official who's responsible for all kinds of different policy initiatives. Not only are they responsible for ag and ag issues, but they're also deal with issues with respect to free and reduced lunch menus, items. They also are in charge of all kinds of different investigations and checking of various weights and measures across the state, including when you fill up with gas at the gas pump, are you getting your 11 gallons on the nose. That's what the ag commissioner does. So this is a race that doesn't tend to get on people's radar, but this could be something that changes here in 2018. So what's your take on this?
Well, this is a much more important race. I think sometimes people recognize back in 1990, a little known state representative by the name of Rick Perry switched parties at the 11th hour and beat Jim Hightower and became the first sort of Republican to win in this modern era, right? And it created this sort of wave effect. And he subsequently, as you know, moved on to many other things.
In fact,
I never heard of him. I think there's a book in the coming there, Brandon. Right. You should think about that. But you might be seeing the same thing here. Kim Olson is a decorated retired veteran, farmer, a third, fourth generation Texan, Democratic nominee, really charismatic, gives a great stump speech, running against what might be the most controversial statewide elected official, Sid Miller, who I know we've made fun of in the past. Heck, Sid Miller's made fun of Sid Miller in the past.
Right.
You know, he's retweeted, you know, fake news, made incendiary comments about everyone and anyone.
Yeah. My favorite is the Jesus shot, right?
Yes,
where
he was
accused of using state funds to go to Oklahoma to get a certain kind of cortisone shot to kind of alleviate former rodeo injuries.
Yeah, to say he's colorful is kind, right? But I mean, it's an important race. Kim Olson's an interesting candidate. The office itself has huge ramifications, but I think the politics of it are interesting because I think it could potentially sort of lead to this state becoming a two-party state.
Yeah, this is, I think, a winnable match on paper for Democrats, right? This is a no-nonsense retired colonel. She reminds me of Ann Richards. She is blunt, she cuts to the quick, and she doesn't suffer fools. This is versus a gaffe-prone drugstore cowboy like Sid Miller, who is often sticking his own foot in his mouth, sometimes with Facebook. And so there is, I think, a real race here. But it could be that some of Olson's past may come back to haunt her, right? The Texas Tribune reports and others have reported earlier that she had some issues with her time in the Air Force. She was discharged from the Air Force. It wasn't a dishonorable discharge, but there were issues with respect to her creating or connecting to a company that had a financial stake in some work that the government was doing in Iraq. So it's not going to be a clean win for her. It's not going to be an easy campaign, but I think the fact that she's keeping fundraising pace with him shows that he's vulnerable. But to me, the path to victory is not so clear.
Yeah, I think that the challenge she faces is the generic advantage Republicans still have in the straight ticket. And so part of the problem is that she has to beat him by a much larger margin. Back in 1990, we knew there was a 50-50 race. Ann Richards, Clinton Williams was a very close race at the top of the ticket. She doesn't have the luxury because we know that Greg Abbott is so far ahead of Lupe Valdez and probably won't, actually, that really won't be much of a race. So she's going to have to do a lot of it on her own, hoping for Beto O'Rourke's sort of glow to just cast over the ticket. But I do think it's a much more competitive race than it probably otherwise would be. Outside of the straight ticket, I think she beats him. The question is just going to be, how low will that straight ticket vote be? We've seen that the core Republican support has really, I think, solidified but gotten smaller. So they're more conservative, they're more pro-Trump, but there's just fewer Republicans, a lot more independents. It'll be interesting to see what the straight ticket numbers look like. And that might mean someone like Kim Olson ends up as ad commissioner, and you could be ushering in a whole new era.
It's a really good point, I think. The problem is that the farther down the ballot, the farther from the tops of most voters' minds. So people don't necessarily know what the ag commissioner does, let alone who's running. And so this, I think, is the biggest problem that Kim Olson faces, as well as the other statewide Democrats. Also, it's the case that Abbott's massive ad buy, right, $16 million, has taken all the oxygen out of the room for any other statewide official. So whether or not Dan Patrick is well-liked, whether or not Sid Miller is known to be somebody who's, you know, off kilter and sends these missives out into the world, I think that those things are less relevant than just the natural effect that something like Greg Abbott's popularity, as well as a Republican natural advantage, like you say, is going to bring to Republicans.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you, we're going to make our predictions on this race for you and let you know who we think is going to win.
So, Jay, this could be a really interesting race. Like you say, historically, this has been one of those kind of bellwether type of elections. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I think it's going to get awfully close. And I think a lot of it depends on things like the straight ticket. If you can get it down, if the generic advantage for Republicans starts to get compressed, I still think Republicans are going to win overwhelmingly the majority of the statewide offices. This might be the one to watch that could be a sneaker, particularly if she gets support from the Farm Bureau and some agriculture-related groups. Because I think she's going to do well in urban Texas.
Yeah. I don't think that Sid Miller pays a very high price for his actions. I think that the tolerance is pretty high because ideologically he's consistent with most Republicans. I think the fact that these races are not about substance in terms of governing, they're more about politics, means that it's really hard for Democrat to win on issues of competency. So I don't think that it's going to be as close as you do. I already owe you a Shiner Bock, maybe a Puffy Taco, so I could be wrong. But I think that given the obscurity of this race, it's going to be really hard for Democrats to kind of break through the public consciousness.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci. Special kudos to our web whiz, Giselle Bueno, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the Commish Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.